Welcome back to another episode of Ignite Your Power, the Kathy Mao podcast, where we dive deep into the stories, tools, and truths that help us step into our highest selves. Today's episode is one you don't want to miss. I'm joined by Viscount Rockdale Jonathan Kemp, an entrepreneur, former law enforcement official, and mental health advocate. His brand new memoir, Finding Peace of Mind, takes us on his powerful journey through bipolar disorder, depression, addiction, and dyslexia. What makes Jonathan's story so impactful is that it reminds us that privilege, titles, and success don't protect us from invisible battles. His life is proof that mental health struggles can hide behind the brightest smiles and the most polished resumes, but it's also proof that healing, resilience, and clarity are possible. In this conversation, we explore how to recognize the battles we often don't talk about, why so many high-achieving people delay seeking help, and the powerful foundations Jonathan built to not just survive, but thrive. If you've ever felt like you had to hold it all together on the outside while breaking on the inside, this episode will meet you exactly where you are. So let's step into this inspiring journey and ignite our power with Jonathan Kemp. Hi, Jonathan. Thanks for being here.
Hi, Kathy. Thank you very much for having me. Much appreciated.
Yes, I'm so excited to tap into your story. What brought you into your battles and how you rose up from them with the mental health issues? So yeah, let's talk about the most common invisible battles people often face, and why are they so easy to miss even in ourselves?
Yes, it's a good question. And I was thinking, I have been thinking about that. And I think one reason is that it's all too easy to think we're okay, even when things are really not okay. And as things progress, as things get worse, it becomes the new normal. And so, you know, in my head, what I think's okay, if I described it to someone else, they'd go, hold on a second, this is not right. You know, you need to get professional help. And actually that I had that very conversation with someone when I walked in front of a bus, actually. And I'd had a disagreement with someone. I was really angry. I didn't intend to kill myself, but I just, rather than confronting the person who had crossed over the road, I just walked in front of a bus and sort of challenged it to stop. It stopped, and then I walked in front of two taxis. And the second one, they said, are you trying to kill yourself or something? And I wasn't. It was just, I was so angry, and I was looking for an outlet. And over the next coming weeks, I told a few of my friends, and I remember one of them said, you know, I'd said, well, I knew they were going to stop anyway. And they said, how did you know that? And followed by, you have to get professional help quickly. Yeah. And that sort of cut through all my rationalizations. And yes, I went and got more professional help.
That's amazing that you were able to communicate your frustrations and then got the help, because a lot of us notice it, are aware, and then don't have the courage, or just in general feel like, oh, I'm not worthy enough or something to get that help, or it could be prideful. There's so many different reasons why people don't take the action to get that help. And so you actually took that action to do that, which is great. And is it because you got to a point where you noticed it and you're just like, I don't want to live like this anymore and you want to change? Or what was that change in you to actually get that help? Because I'm sure this happened for many years, right? You were not to this point just out of nowhere. I'm sure your childhood or whatever led you into that moment to get that help.
Yeah, so that happened when I was about 39, 40. And leading up to then, there had been other moments where slightly different to that, but where I'd sort of hit a fork in the road and I just couldn't carry on doing what I was doing and reached out for help. And I joined 12-step fellowships. Probably the best known is either Alcoholics Anonymous, Narcotics Anonymous, Gamblers Anonymous. And there's 12-step fellowships for every type of addiction, whether it's a physical addiction or a substance addiction. And so I'd been involved in fellowships from quite an early age, from I think I first went in my teens, late teens. I stopped going and I went back in my mid-20s. So I was used to sort of talking to people, telling people what was going on. But I thought that all my problems centered around, you know, an addictive personality. And it was only by, you know, working those programs, finding out that that wasn't a solution, that, you know, I'd hit a sort of roadblock. I'd ask for help. But the one help I didn't ask for was professional medical help. Mm-hmm. And I had to literally try everything else before I was prepared to do that, because I saw it as a weakness.
You saw it as a weakness. Why do you think that you saw it as a weakness?
It's a really good question. And I think it's a combination of things. So it's partly historical. So in the 70s and 80s, but certainly in the 70s, there was not a lot known about mental illnesses. I mean, we knew about people who had sort of manic depression or psychosis. And we sort of knew about mental hospitals, and we knew that psychiatrists, you know, looked after, we use slang terms, you know, a psychiatrist would look after a nutter, and somebody who had a mental illness was a nutcase. So I think it's partly historical. Mm-hmm. And in combination with that, it's historical. We didn't really talk about our thoughts and feelings, and that didn't really happen for me until I sort of participated in 12-step fellowships. Mm-hmm. But overriding in my mind that I had to be able to mentally think myself better, that what was going on inside my head was something that I should be able to control, and I was weak, and or it was a weakness that I couldn't do it. Wow. That's how I saw it. And so I resisted. And it wasn't, I think I was about 39 when I first saw a therapist. Mm-hmm. And for me, and I'd never told a doctor about what was going on either. And for some bizarre reason, I don't think it would have even occurred to me to tell a doctor. So I hadn't really made the connection between what was going on in my head was actually a medical condition. I don't think I've made that connection. It sounds a bit surreal now. I just hit another fork in the road, and, you know, it was either do something or call it a day. And under much, with much reluctance, I went to see a therapist.
Yeah.
Having said all of that, I now see it very differently today.
Yeah, that's so beautiful. And your story is literally an example of how you can overcome mental health, and it's not a shameful thing, and you can get the help and live a life that makes you fulfilled, happy, and living in your authentic truth and self, which is the best. But let's go back to your childhood, or how you led up to your realization of finally getting that help, because a lot of people struggle in that in between before they get to getting that help. So how was it in your teens and 20s and 30s? Because do you feel like since you have the title and you grew up in a certain type of environment or family situation, do you feel like they put a lot of pressure on you? And since you had dyslexia as well, did it hold you back in certain ways to kind of lead you to getting mental health or having mental health issues? And then, you know, finally you overcoming that, we know that, but what was it like in your childhood and earlier years in your life?
Yeah. So actually an interesting thing, certainly for myself, is that I will never have a solution, as it were, to my mental health illnesses or the dyslexia. Those are things that I will have for all of my life, and I need to manage them. And because of what I know now and because of the medical help I've had, it's now substantially easier to do that. But certainly on a day-to-day basis, you know, I'm consciously aware that I need to be careful and mindful of sort of what I'm doing and what I'm not doing, because I could easily trigger another bipolar episode. But going back to when I was growing up, the thing that sort of really sticks out to me was a general feeling that, okay, I came from a privileged background. I went to boarding schools from age 7 to age 18, which was quite normal with the people I knew. But what I didn't feel, and I didn't tell anyone actually, was I didn't feel that I belonged. I didn't feel I belonged either at the schools. I wish I'd gone to different schools. I didn't feel I belonged to my family. I didn't feel I belonged or, you know, associated with any of my background. And in my head, I'd always wish, you know, I'd been born somewhere else, brought up somewhere else, had a different family. Yeah. But I think, and I've only had this realization relatively recently, I think however and wherever I'd been born, I would have felt that way, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And actually the problem was that it was the mental health issues that were making me feel that way. And so whatever situation I'd actually been in, I would have had that feeling. Excuse me. But I certainly, on top of that, I also never really felt that I belonged to the background that I was born into. It just didn't feel right.
Mm. And do you feel like since it never felt right, it gave you pressure, or you just felt like you had to hold a lot of your authenticity and who you really were, like, back? And then did you feel like it restricted you in some way to be authentically you?
I never articulated it as clearly as that. But certainly when I was at school, you know, I really struggled with studying, rarely got good exam results. And by about the age of 16, I just thought, I've had enough. And so I rebelled within the structures that I was living. So when I was supposed to be studying, I was all night fishing. I got into skateboarding because skateboarding had just come over to the UK. And then I got really into punk rock music, which had just started. Yeah, the whole music scene, the bands, the image, the words, the music, it all really resonated. Yeah, and I was about to say it's a lifesaver. It probably was a lifesaver. You know, it gave me a sort of sense of belonging, of meaning.
That's beautiful that you found something. And I feel like your story is a reflection of my story as well, even though I didn't grow up with the title, etc. But in the Asian culture or the Asian community, right, like you're already entrapped into doing a certain thing or a certain way. And I felt like I was being pressured to be one way when I wanted to go a different route. And a lot of us go through this, right? It's just a different generation. And so I felt like that did cause a lot of mental health issues growing up, because then I started being more aware and then understanding, like, why am I this way or that way, right? And then you're battling your thoughts and your actions and your beliefs, and you're just like, whoa, this is a lot. So I'm just always curious about, like, how your childhood led you into where you are now. And so, yeah, just a little bit of that pressure too, I feel, in your childhood has brought you to also the point in your life as an adult. And that's beautiful that you're able to overcome that. And so How many years has it taken you since you said you were 39 when you got help? So what did that look like from then and then to now?
So 39 was when I first got professional medical help. I saw a therapist. Their sort of main finding after the first meeting, they said to me, "You're clinically depressed." And I said, "No, I'm not." And I genuinely believe that to be the case. But I was later to discover, once I took medication for depression, that actually, because that was my normal and had been my normal for 20 plus years at that point, probably 30 years, I couldn't associate what was going on with me with this thing called depression, because it was just the way things were. I then saw another therapist who then gave me the same diagnosis. And it was a gradual process. So the second therapist I saw, I felt more comfortable with, and I saw them on a weekly basis. And they spent about a year trying to persuade me to see a psychiatrist. So each step of the sort of medical journey, I resisted. The same reasons as, I didn't go in the first place. I saw it as an admission of defeat. Mm-hmm. But the important thing for me now is, looking back, I realize I was applying one rule for one part of my body and a different rule for every other part. So if I had a problem with my nose, my ears, my eyes, my teeth, my throat, or any other part of my body, at some point, I'd go and see a doctor. I wouldn't think, oh, I should change career. I need to make more money. I need to go to university. I need to change my diet. I need to go on a rigorous exercise regime. I need to do all of them simultaneously. That isn't going to fix my throat problem or my ear problem.
Yeah.
But I expected some of those, or just mental willpower, to fix what was going on in my brain. And it's only relatively recently I've sort of realized that I was applying this double standard, one standard for my brain, which I thought I should be able to fix in the ways that I've described, another to the rest of my body. And now I know, with mental health issues, if you have a mental illness, whether it's, what I've got, bipolar disorder, or you've got psychosis or schizophrenia, or you're suffering from depression or anxiety, whatever it is, if you have a mental illness, it is a brain illness. The best people to help you with that are people who are medical professionals who specialize in those areas.
Yeah, thank you for explaining that. I really believe that your brain also should be checked up. And again, I believe that we're not taught that, though. We're not taught mental health issues can be clinically or diagnosed, and we're more on the ashamed side of talking about it or bringing it up to the doctor. And just like you said, if you had an ear infection or some type of infection, you would automatically go to the doctor. You wouldn't say, oh, I have this condition, I'm going to cure it myself or figure it out myself. And your mental is so hard to actually do that on your own, to change that perspective on your own. Because if you've always been that way and you were depressed for 20 years and you didn't even know that you were, so how would you be able to pinpoint, I got depression and I'm going to have to do these things to change my life? Like, that's not going to happen until you go and get that help and someone's there to truly help you, diagnose you, get you on the right track. And I know last time we talked, you were explaining to me how you finally found a great doctor. And I truly believe that's part of it too. When you do go get the help, do you get the right help? And how did you find that person to get the right help? Because I know a lot of people struggle with finding the correct doctor or the right doctor. And me with endometriosis, I have the same situation. There's doctors who really think, oh, you have no help. There's no cure, nothing you can do. Yes, there's no cure for endometriosis, but they're like, yeah, it's just a painful period problem, go away, pretty much, right? And then there's some doctors who truly want to help and to figure out what we can do with this current situations to make your life better. So I know you found that, and if you wanted to talk about that, so people with mental health issues have a way of, or a hope, like knowing, hey, there are people that are really there to advocate for your health or your mental health.
Yeah. So, I mean, you're quite right. At different times, I've been fortunate in that I've come across people who've, you know, been able to accurately diagnose the challenges that I've got, and to be able to give me workable solutions. And that's happened probably off the top of my head, maybe three or four times. So the first one, well, probably more actually, five or six times. So the first one was the second therapist I saw. I then happened to see someone who would come actually from the US, came over to the UK and ran courses. And he was instrumental in me getting medical help. So I'd resisted going to see a psychiatrist. When I eventually went to see a psychiatrist, they were strongly recommending that I should take medication for the depression. And I resisted it. And eventually, a lot of the reason was this American professional. He persuaded me to take medication. And after about 3 months, my brain cleared for the first time ever. And it was only then that I realized what depression was, because I had something to compare it with, which was a clear brain. And then what's quite common with people with bipolar is often we're assessed as having depression, because that's the reason we often go in there and see a doctor. But sometimes the bipolar gets missed, because the times that we go are the times that we're really struggling. And so I was just taking medication for depression, and but I was still having these huge mood swings, and I had another mood swing, and I was just at my wit's end. And actually, I went to a treatment center in the US. So some friends had been there. Mm-hmm. They said it was really good, really professional. And I took out a bank loan and went to the US. And it was there that, I think on my second day, the psychiatrist diagnosed me with bipolar disorder.
Wow. And so when you finally got the different diagnosis from depression to bipolar, what was different that they did and that they gave you different medication, or, you know, or it was easier to pinpoint why you had those ups and downs and to make it more linear, or like less, I guess, extreme from the depression to like the normal, or I don't know how that kind of looks, but what's the difference between your depression and the bipolar?
So the depression is a feature of bipolar.
Okay.
However, I sort of say that I've got both, because I think there have been times where, you know, I have been depressed for long, long periods, and the bipolar hasn't been active per se. But the big difference is with depression, if that's feeling normal, mm-hmm. then depression, and let's say a 4 or a 5 is feeling normal, then a depression, you know, feeling down is probably a 3. 2 is a sort of depression, and a 1 is a heavy depression, clinical depression. With bipolar, you have mood fluctuations, so of which you've got no control. And they're really subtle. So there are different types of bipolar. And there's type 1, where when you go high, you go into mania, which is psychosis. Mm-hmm. And so the only safe way of dealing with that is to go to hospital, get onto medication, which then brings you back to a midpoint. I have bipolar disorder type 2, where when I go high, I have hypomania. And what that means is that everything is accentuated. So, you know, I'm really analytical and I'm highly sort of process driven. So I'll go into like hyper analysis, hyper planning, hyper organization. But I won't fortunately cross that dividing line between living and being in an alternative reality. Having said that, you know, I will take lots of risks. I'll take huge financial risks. And I'm infused with an optimism, you know, everything is going to be fine and everything will work out. And so I take all sorts of risks on the back of that will happen. And at some point, the stress becomes so much that my brain will just flip, and it's over a 24-hour period and crash. And for about the first 2 to 4 weeks, it's like my brain's been removed. And I've got this sandstorm roaring around inside my head, grating away on the inside of my skull. And I know it's never going to finish, even though I've had it numerous times. But when I'm in it, I am absolutely certain it will never finish. And that is why I can see why people with bipolar disorder might call it a day, because when you're in that situation and it's going on, the sort of thinking part of your brain, it just stops working. It's very, very powerful. And so I can see why in that situation, you know, you can feel desperate enough to say, I'm not going to do this anymore. Yeah. But that'll last about 2 weeks, 2 to 4 weeks. And then for my brain to sort of return to a medium usually takes between 4 to 8 weeks. Mm. But the way I used to get out of it was by focusing on work. Mm. And I'd become like laser focused. I'd force myself to phone up, make sales calls, go to sales meetings. And it was that that helped me to pull out of the bipolar crashes. But the problem was that laser focus then created everything for another high to happen.
Mm.
And so I was on this like continual cycle. It's been a sort of process of education. And for me, COVID was like a really key moment. So I thought COVID would be easy. You know, I know what shit feels like. It's been that way for whatever, 30, 40 years plus. You know, COVID should be a walk in the park. It was a nightmare. You know, I hadn't realized the importance of social interaction. And with that cut off, that impacted me greatly. And because I was sort of living, although I shared my place with someone, they were usually out working. And I was sort of left with my brain. And by this point, my medication that I've been taking now for nearly 20 years had stopped working, probably stopped working about 5 years before, maybe even 10. And I'd gone back to trying to fix it all myself. And I had about 3 or 4 highs and crashes over that COVID period. And on the last one, I think it was the last one, again, I was in a desperate state. And a couple of things happened. One is that I hadn't really read any books on bipolar at all, actually. And then I bought a lot during COVID, and I read a couple, and then I read some more when I was having this really difficult patch. And it was one by an American psychiatrist where every page I just thought, oh my God, that's me. And it was literally my sort of chin dropped to the floor, because he was describing hypermania, the different aspects of hypermania. And it was like the hyper organization, analysis, planning, you know, you name it, hyper. And that was me 100%. I had no idea that's how the bipolar had been manifesting itself. And then another big realization was that I realized I'd got it everything else about face. So I always thought I needed to be really careful about what to do when I had a crash. During COVID, I realized, actually, I've got this wrong. The only thing I need to do is be super careful not to have a high. Because if I don't have that bipolar high, I'm not going to crash.
Yeah. And so how did you get it to more stable instead of having that high and low, you know, since you have the highs and lows? I feel like you've gotten to a point where it's more stable, right? And you haven't had those high and lows as before.
Well, I would say for most of COVID, I was in quite a deep depression. And deep depression is, again, part of the bipolar disorder. So what happened was, so I'm just thinking, the reason I'm pausing, I'm just thinking back, that I'd reached, another point of desperation. And I was on my way out. You know, I mean, I've put up with this nonsense for 40, 50 years, and I just thought, I've had enough of it. And I realized I was getting very close to calling it a day. And I went and I thought, okay, I'm going to give this one more go. And I remember I'd written what's called an emergency action plan for the book I was writing. And I couldn't for the life of me remember what it said. So I fired up my laptop, had a look. And number one was to keep an open mind and be willing. So when I'm struggling, the last thing I am is open-minded and willing. I just want to like retreat off into a corner of the field, sit there and bury my head in the sand. Number two was to go and see a medical practitioner. And again, that's not what I want to do when I'm struggling. And number three is to do what, and number three, we're 10 in total, I think. But number three was to do what they suggested. And so because I was in a desperate state, that's exactly what I did. It was about early 2022, I think. I saw my local doctor. They immediately referred me to a psychiatrist. Psychiatrist immediately said, you need to change medication. So with bipolar disorder, what I've learned is for most people with bipolar, the only effective way of managing those mood swings is through medication to give you that sort of level of stability around somewhere between a 4 and a 6.
Oh, wow.
And, but each medication affects everyone differently. So if you and I had exactly the same type of bipolar disorder, you might take one medication and it's fantastic. I'll take it and it just throws me into a deep depression. So it's a bit of a trial and error, which is the reason I'd never changed. Mm. I took one medication, which was a mood stabilizer, and I actually ended up with a sort of medically enhanced depression, which was awful.
Yeah.
And then I put up with that for about 2 weeks. I went back to the doctor, and then he referred me to the psychiatrist again. And then she got me to take an antidepressant in combination with the mood stabilizer. And after about 6 weeks, it was like a miracle. It wasn't an effort to think, wasn't an effort to be, to breathe, wasn't an effort to walk along the street. Whereas, you know, before everything felt like a huge effort. And it was, I'd wake up in the morning and my brain was clear. It's like a complete miracle. And it's been pretty much that way for the last 2.5 years.
Yay! I love hearing that. That's amazing. That's so awesome. I'm glad that, you know, you led yourself into finding the help that you needed to get the help so you can be clear. And how does that feel, being clear? Like you said, it's like, is it like a breath of fresh air or not having to do that? Do you feel like a shift in energy wise?
Yeah, I think probably the easiest way to describe it is the lightness of being. So doing things, whatever it is, requires much less effort than everything before.
Mm-hmm.
And it's much easier and almost effortless just to appreciate, you know, simple things, whether it's, you know, like wind brushing against my hands, or it's the sun on my face, or it's, you know, the shadows in the trees. I'm able to appreciate simple things in the moment much more easily. I'm also much more aware of my behavior. You know, if I meet new people and I feel I'm talking too much, I will, if I notice it, I will then think, actually, I need to just sort of dial things back a bit. But it's in general, yeah, I would say the easiest way to describe it, it's a lightness of being. So when I wake up, I still don't feel 100%, but within 20 to 30 minutes, I feel okay. And okay is really good. Yeah. Whereas before, you know, I'd have to get up at 6:30, have a long list, start working through it. And if I kept going somewhere between 12 and 2 in the afternoon, I might start to feel vaguely normal. And I had to do that every day.
Thank you for sharing that. It's just getting a point of view of how it is to live with this condition and how mental health really does affect just simple tasks in your daily life. And that's just so exhausting to live that way. So let's go back to your emergency action plan list. So how did you come up with this? How did this actually come about? Because that's so cool. I know that you believe that everybody should have this emergency action plan. So if you wanted to explain how you thought of that and how you kind of explained it, how it helped you a little bit when you had an episode and then you looked at your list. But where did you get that idea to write one?
So as it happens, if you speak to a medical professional or you phone up charities. So in the last couple of years, I've used a few mental health charities, which I'd never done before. And that's been very, very helpful. And they will, if you're phoning someone up in crisis, they will recommend and try and help you create a sort of crisis action plan. So actually they're quite common. But when I wrote mine, I wasn't aware of that. And the reason I wrote one was because of this feature of the bipolar, that when I crash, it is quite literally like my brain has been removed. And just thinking about anything is a huge struggle. I can't remember anything. And so the reason I wrote one was when I have the crash, therefore, I can just fire up my laptop, look at a list and just follow it. And it doesn't require any thought. So that was the reason I created one. I later realized that actually it's very common within mental health circles to do this. The reason when I was compiling the list, one thing that I was very aware of was, and I've put it in the book, strategic points, is that what works for one person won't necessarily work for anybody else. So I have a list. I recommend other people to do a list, but for each person, it might be slightly different, and that's completely normal. Or it might be very different, and that's completely normal. And so what I did is I worked out my list, and then I put it in order of priority. And I think it was both of those things were important. But the reason I put open-minded and willingness as number one, and I remember when I thought about it and I started writing about it, I felt this like, in my body, because I really don't want to go and speak to anyone about what's going on. You know, it's deep in the marrow of my bones. I want to solve it myself, even knowing everything I know. So I realized that if I'm going to get out of whatever problem I'm in, number one has to be that I've got to become open-minded and willing. And then that then leads on to number two, which is basically do what I never did before, which is go and see a medical professional. So for me, I'm lucky I've got a very good local doctor. And that is the next port of call. And then just whatever they say, do it. And so when I did have this really bad turn 2.5 years ago and I saw the GP, she asked me to phone up charities. I'd never phoned a charity in my life. And again, to me, I thought, I'm not going to do that. And then she said, I'm going to phone you again at 4 o'clock in the afternoon to make sure you've done it.
Yeah.
So, okay. And actually phoning up the charities was incredibly helpful. And there are some bipolar charities in the UK. And through one of them, I'd go to like monthly meetings, which is run by the charity and is for people who have bipolar. And they have meetings all over the UK. And yeah, just being part of that community, all these things sort of add up and make a difference. So now my willingness to phone a charity, I wouldn't really think twice about it. But when I was first asked a couple of years ago, yeah, I thought I didn't want to do it. But because I promised myself I was going to do what I was told, I did.
That's awesome. And yeah, when you did it, you actually got good results that you wanted, that you needed, you know. And sometimes you really don't know what you need at a really low point in your life. And you definitely can't count on your brain or your mental state to bring you the answers when you're so low, you know. So that's great. And you got the help. So let's get into your book, Finding Peace of Mind. How did you come about writing a book or wanting to write this book? Yeah, what was the passion or the underlying message? Obviously, it's about mental health and finding peace, but yeah, what's your inspiration?
So the title comes from when I left school and I decided to try and get my act together. It was about the time I moved to Australia. I lived in Australian outback, worked as a cowboy for a year. And I made a conscious decision that I was now really going to try and give my best shot at life. And, you know, maybe that would make a difference. And I had two objectives. One, to prove that I wasn't stupid, because I'd convinced myself I was stupid because of the dyslexia. And the second one was to find peace of mind, which is actually what I was describing to you was a result of taking the medication. You know, to live, to be, just wasn't an effort anymore. Another way of describing it is, you know, complete peace of mind. And then I thought about writing a book a couple of times. And during COVID, I decided that actually I was still driven, and I think in part because of my background, to do something worthwhile. And I still had this, I was still driven by the idea of trying to create wealth. And I decided actually during the COVID period that I could actually make my own definition of wealth. It didn't have to be money or didn't have to be a, you know, a particular achievement. And I thought, well, my greatest wealth is in fact my 40 plus years experience with mental health and neurodiversity. And I thought, okay, and that sort of made sense to me. And I thought, success therefore can be putting all that knowledge and experience into the public field to benefit others. And that's the reason I wrote the book. But I wasn't prepared to write it, and I certainly wasn't prepared to publish it unless I had a period of mental stability. I wouldn't have felt comfortable doing it. You know, let's say on this phone call, if I was really struggling, I just wouldn't feel comfortable doing it.
Yeah. But yay, you got it out there. When is it coming out? Or is it out?
Not yet. So it's on the 10th of October is going to be released.
Yeah, October 10th. I'm into angel numbers, but it's just, I had to point it out. You did it on 10-10, so that's awesome. October 10th.
What I'm going to do is all profits from the book are going to, for the first year, are going to 3 or 4 mental health charities.
That's so beautiful. I love that. That's amazing. You're doing amazing work.
January the 1st, I don't know if I mentioned this to you, I'm going to do a 7-month charity walk. Did I mention that?
No, you did not. Yeah, let's talk about it. What is this? This is awesome. If my listeners and I can encourage you and to help with your cause, yeah, let's do it.
So I had two sort of aspects of this sort of drive. One was, you know, to create and have a wealth. So I'd sort of tick that box with my experience in mental health, neurodiversity. And then the other big driver for me that's always been there is success. And I decided that actually, again, I can define my own success. And I decided that success would be to do my best to put my knowledge into the public sphere. That's it. And so as part of that, I then had this idea of doing a walk. And during the walk, doing talks on mental health. And that's how the idea started. So I will be starting in the north of Scotland. There are some islands north of Scotland called the Shetland Islands. And I'll be starting there on the 1st of January next year. And I'll be walking through Scotland, then England, then up through Wales, then across the Irish Sea, and then down the length of Ireland. And it'll take 7 months. In some of the major towns and cities, I'm going to stop for a day or 2 days to enable me to do talks. Yeah. And in addition to that, I'm going to set myself targets. So like one target is doing 30 talks on mental health. Another target is doing 30 in-person, small, short in-person interviews with people I meet on the way about mental well-being. Another target is doing 30 blogs or vlogs about the experience. So there's going to be the combination of doing the walk and then also meeting these targets, which will help me from a mental health point of view, because it means that in addition to the walk, that I have a really clear focus on a daily and weekly basis.
That's amazing. I love that. You're such an inspiration. And that's awesome. That's even more beautiful is to show people who have mental health issues that you can accomplish something so huge. Like you set out a huge goal and you're going to do this. And that's going to take 7 months. That's amazing. Wow. That's a lot.
That's really interesting because until you'd mentioned that, I hadn't really made that connection that the walk would also be a demonstration to show what is possible, even if you do have mental health illnesses. Until you mentioned that just now, I hadn't made that connection.
Yeah, because think about it. You just told me your story of like how doing little daily tasks was so complicated and such a battle. And now you're like out setting this, you know, setting a goal of this huge goal, which not even I can do, right? So that's amazing. That truly is an inspiration that, hey, you can get better. And now I'm going to do these amazing things. So you're not letting your mental health hold you back. And that's just such an inspiration. So that's awesome. That's so cool. And it's funny how you didn't realize that, but see, when you're exuding like inspiration and amazingness, you don't even think about how amazing you truly are. You're just doing it. You're just being it. And you just forget that. So that's amazing. If you could leave our audience with one empowering message, what would it be?
It's a really good question. And I had a thought about that. And I think the thing I thought of were a couple of things that really helped me. And so one of them is I often have this feeling that actually, less so now, for a long time, I had this feeling that, you know, I was a failure, you know, I was wasting my time, or particularly each individual day, I haven't done enough. You know, if I didn't get up at 6 a.m. and start at 6:30, I haven't done enough. And one thing that really helps me is a saying that I came up with is that I can start my day again at any time. And so today I didn't have a particularly good morning and I thought, right, I can start at probably about 2 o'clock. I thought, right, I can start my day again at any time. And so that saying I find really, really helpful. And then combined with that and combined with this sort of tendency of thinking, oh, you know, I'm a failure or I'm no good at whatever it is. When I start thinking that, I ask myself a question. Am I trying my best? Because that's all I can do is make the most of today and try my best. That's the very most I can do. And if I'm doing those two things, then, you know, give myself a break.
Yeah. And that's great. Same thing. I feel like most of us are, right? We're always struggling within ourselves. Like, we want to do it all. We're trying to accomplish so much in a day, but what can you focus on and how can you reset and just start over? And so those are great. Thank you so much for today. Last but not least, where can we find more about you and where can people pre-order or start ordering your book?
Yes, by all means. So I'm in the process of creating an author website, which is jonathankemp.com. And that should be up and running when the podcast is released. So that'd be the main port of call. And there you'll find out about the walk and also where to buy the book. And once it goes live on the 10th of October, it should be available in most online stores.
Awesome. I can't wait to get a hold of the book and support you and see your amazing, you know, journey in the 7 months. I want to see all the impact that you're making in the world, which is so cool. So thank you so much for today. So being open, honest, and really giving us a view of how it really is to live with bipolar and mental health issues, and to know that, hey, even though you struggle for so long, there's an end to it. There's help, and, you know, there's a light at the end of the tunnel. So thank you for showing that today. And thank you for being here. And I'm just so honored that you spent your time with me today and to hop on this call, even though you had a crappy morning. Because, you know, when you have your day and you wake up with so much negativity, usually that's how your day ends up. And so I love how you just said reset, and then you resetted your day and showed up. And yeah, this was awesome. So thank you so much.
Well, thank you very much for having me. It's been really nice having a chat.
Yes. Thank you so much for spending this time with me on Ignite Your Power, the Kathy Mao podcast. If today's episode resonated with you, take a deep breath and know this, you're exactly where you're meant to be. If you're feeling called to go deeper, I'd love to support you. You can work with me one-on-one or book a numerology guidance card reading with me. All are in the show links below. And if this episode supported you in any way, please share with someone who needs it, leave a review, or take a screenshot and tag me on social media. Your support helps this message reach more souls who are ready to step into their power. Until next time, keep choosing yourself, keep trusting your journey, and keep living your bliss-soft life. I'll see you in the next episode. Bye!